Welcome to the TF Blockchain Podcast, where we interview blockchain, Bitcoin, and cryptocurrency innovators actively building, growing, and investing in this emerging technology. I'm your host and founder of TF Blockchain, Jonathan G. Blanco. TF Blockchain hosts quarterly conferences and monthly events live recorded for this podcast. Our current chapters are located in Seattle, Portland, Vancouver, San Francisco, Austin, San Antonio, and Dallas. Our upcoming conferences will be TF5 in Seattle on March 19th, 2020, and TF6 in Austin on June 4th, 2020. To get involved with TF Blockchain, participate in future TF conferences, attend a chapter in your area, or to start a new chapter, please visit tfblock.io. Hey, I want to share a special promo with you from our friends over at CoinMine, so you can get your very own CoinMine 1 and mine cryptocurrency from your house in the simplest way possible. I have one, I love it, and I want to make sure you can get one too. So visit coinmine.com/tfblock and use discount code TFBLOCK to get $50 off. This podcast is presented by TF Labs, a blockchain product and startup studio. TF Labs collaborates with companies from growth stage to enterprise in order to establish their blockchain product strategy. As a startup studio, TF Labs builds and validates internal products to one day be spun out as companies. To partner or get involved with TF Labs, please visit us at tflabs.io.
I host events for this one. There's this organization that they do tech events for kids all the time, and so the kids will pitch. It's actually pretty interesting. They kind of work together. We're kind of like a startup weekend. They'll work together and they pitch an idea and so forth. And so they have a lot of fun. And so every time one of the kids gets brought up to pitch, I'll tell the audience, I was like, okay, I want you to cheer for this person. Like they're like a famous, you know, executive or a famous founder, right? And what's funny is the kids, you know, like you'll hear the adults say things like, I don't know, Steve Jobs or Bill Gates. And then like the kids are always like, Elon Musk, or they'll even say, a couple of them said Tony Stark, which I thought was really awesome, Iron Man. So, anyways, all right, so we'll go ahead and get started. Well, welcome TF Blockchain Seattle. Thank you so much for being here, our first event of 2020. I'm really excited for this year. We got a lot of great events planned, and I'm really excited to welcome back Simon Yu of Storm. Please do me a favor and give him a round of applause and welcome him. Awesome. Simon, good to see you again, man.
Yeah, good to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
Awesome. Well, again, thanks for being here. Love if you could just introduce yourselves real quick to everybody so they can get to know you a little better.
Yeah, my name is Simon Yu. I'm the CEO and co-founder of Storm. So we started back around 2014 in the blockchain space. My last job was in underwriting at KeyBank, which I think the underwriting office is closed now. But back when I was in banking, I was really excited about Bitcoin because it kept popping up in the news for the wrong reasons, like Silk Road and basically Mt. Gox, which is the largest exchange that had 70% of the Bitcoin volume got hacked and everyone lost their money. And so it just kept, you know, coming up as, you know, a tool for smuggling drugs or this tool that everyone just lost their money. But at the same time, I started reading into the white paper. And I thought that this was immediately going to disrupt banking because of all the transaction fees that was going to happen.
And you're like, I need a new job.
Yeah. So, I mean, yeah, it's like, oh, my God, like, why am I still here kind of thing? Because just kind of like the thing that I saw was like back in the 90s, we had relatives in Korea. So we used to call people with prepaid phone cards because it was too expensive. And then, you know, when MSN sort of came out in like 2000, that started becoming really popular. We used to call our relatives with MSN and that became free. So it's like you didn't have to pay $20 every week to call your grandma and stuff like that. And then it's like this. And then at that time, like AT&T was acquired by Singular and they were going through this crazy hurdle and like profit margins were taking a huge loss. And like the same thing was going to happen to banking. So I met my co-founder and then we did the startup, and it's been almost like 6 years now, and we're just continuing to go and growing. So
that's awesome. That's awesome. Well, I know you've been entrepreneurial pretty much your whole life. I know even before this, you started like a food business, right?
Kinda, yeah.
And that helped you kick things off too, right?
Yeah,
financially.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about that real quick.
Yeah. So I went to the UW when I was 19. I was a sophomore, and then my parents they went bankrupt. They had a small business, didn't do well, so I started I told him that I was going to quit school because I was from Oregon. I was paying out of state tuition, and I told him, like, I'm just going to save up money and I'll go back to UW. So I found a full-time job at Bank of America, but they're paying me like $12 an hour and I didn't have enough money. So it was either I get a second job or I try to find like opportunities where I could earn some side income, but there wasn't like Uber or Airbnb or anything like that back then. So like all you could do, like there wasn't really much options. So my mom had this like killer Korean barbecue recipe. And so I decided to just make Korean tacos out of my apartment and basically just cooked, like did all the driving, like did everything by myself. And I originally asked my dad to let me borrow $100 and he was very against it. He said like, you know, just get a good job, don't be like me, and like just being very Asian doctor kind of thing. And so but you know, I really wanted to try it. I blew through the $100 in like 2 weeks, and basically I was left to just eating peanut butter jelly sandwiches pretty for like for every meal. And then after 2 months, I finally had my first two customers and they really loved it, and I asked them to share it on Facebook. And back then Facebook wasn't doing any sort of ad monetization, so when they shared it, it went up to every one of their friends, and then it started going viral. So I started it turned out $100 into 10 grand, and I decided to hold off on that for a little bit. And then I used 10 grand to trade, I taught myself how to trade stock options and turned that into 30 grand, and then got an internship at Amazon, and then started a food truck while I graduated. And then the food truck is still running today, and it's called Bomber Fusion if you want Korean Mexican fusion food. So.
Nice. No, I love that story. I love that. Like, I, just the hustle, turn a little bit into, you know, kind of gradually more and more and more. So, so take us real quick then through. So, you know, you started Storm. It was Kate Codes originally,
yep.
And then kind of how the idea evolved into start incorporating crypto and Bitcoin and so forth.
Yeah. So I mean, we were
because you're crypto Bitcoin day from the beginning.
Yeah,
right?
We were Bitcoin day one. So we were rewarding users 0.2 cents for watching a small video on an app. And so, you know, my co-founder actually just built this straight out of his dorm room, and I first saw it. I was just really excited about Bitcoin, so we would geek out all the time, and he built this app, and I thought, like, who the hell is going to use this? Like, you're getting, like, a penny for each, like, 2 minutes that you're investing in your life. And I thought it was kind of stupid, but I asked them to show me the metrics. But surprisingly, it was growing, like, 30 to 80%, like, every month, the user base. And so we were like, okay, there's something here. I don't know what it is, but there was definitely an opportunity. So I said, okay, you know, let's put more time into it. And then eventually I put all of my money from my food truck that I was earning, plus the money I was making from KeyBank. I cashed out my 401k and maxed out all my credit cards, and I drove for Uber and Lyft and went all in, and basically like joined them full time in like end of 2015. And we tried to get funding here for a while, and whenever we mentioned Bitcoin, all the investors, VCs or angels thought we were selling drugs. And so we just basically were passed down, and then after a year, like August 2016, we got into 9 Mile Labs, and then we did this B2B incubator, and we started getting equity funding, and then we just kept growing the company. And the opportunity that we saw was that, you know, like 0.2 cents might not be much, but the fact that we can send out transaction fees for virtually zero to anywhere across the world, that was a big opportunity that we saw. And so, like, even if we can pay people like 50 cents to $5, there's a huge opportunity if we can target every single person in the world. And because you need a wallet address and you don't really need a bank account, you can just send it people, you know, without having, you know, like really corrupt banks or governments in certain countries like Mexico where people don't use banks, right?
Right.
And so that was a big opportunity. And, you know, we keep increasing how much users can earn on a daily basis. And so our job is to try to make the platform useful enough that people can actually have a daily wage on our platform. So.
That's excellent. Yeah. And so tell us real quick about the platform. So there's, you know, you perform tasks, and then yeah. I know we'll talk about your new product here in a second.
Yeah.
But how did that kind of originate?
Yeah. So Storm Play, so that the 0.2 cents video advertisement evolved. So, you know, we were constantly looking for ways that people can earn more money. And so it started with watching a video, and then we sort of got into this advertising industry where you can, you know, check out Uber or Airbnb or an app or a product for the first time, and we'll give you like $5 to $200 in, you know, money, but in the form of crypto. And so we basically just work with a ton of different companies. I think we've had over 2,000 different brands on the mobile app, and we've had like 2.5 million users. But it's at the same time, the UX is really tough in crypto because you need a wallet address and things like that. So there's obviously a learning curve, but it's getting a lot better. There's a lot of these fiat on-ramps and companies like Wire that are doing Apple Pay direct integrations, and that it's definitely helping us speed up quite a bit as well.
Yeah. Awesome. And, you know, how have you seen, you know, so you've been in the space 2014, mm-hmm. and, you know, and probably sooner or earlier than that, you know, and from a personal context, you know, how have you seen the adoption and from a UX standpoint and those improvements evolve throughout that time?
Yeah, I mean, like when I first, like Coinbase wasn't even a thing back then, but now, you know, it's like you can just have an email address and send people Bitcoin or Ether through Coinbase. And I think that's one of the best use case.
Yeah.
There's also like, you know, it was only Mt. Gox before, but now there's so many different exchanges that you can do. You can do Bittrex and you can wire money. You can ACH if you want to get into Bitcoin. There's also local companies like CoinMe where you can have an ATM machine where you can just go and buy, you know, buy and sell crypto as well too. And obviously like consumer platforms like ours, we try to make it as easy as possible. And I think enough time is starting to pass where people are, you know, starting to get familiar with Bitcoin outside of just being this really weird tool for all this like black market stuff back in Silk Road days. And then now it's becoming more legitimized. And at the same time, a lot of smart people have started to build really good technology around it and making this easier.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, it's interesting, you know, going back to what you said, like, you know, investors thought Bitcoin was crazy. A lot of people think Bitcoin is crazy. You know, I've had the chance to interview, you know, people from enterprise companies and so forth, mm-hmm. and investors and, you know, startup founders. And what's interesting is that, you know, Bitcoin's always come up, right? And yep. just how the narrative around that has evolved and changed. You know, what do you think it takes to continue that adoption overall? You know, so more people start either purchasing it or using it or earning it like they mm-hmm. can with you. Mm-hmm. What does it take for that?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, we need viral applications, right? So like video games or the internet and stuff like that too, just whatever it was, the technology continues to evolve. But like you can't, a lot of the earlier sort of companies that did come out, the developers were trying to drive it and it wasn't too user friendly, but you know, sort of how like Nintendo 64 and Super Nintendo made video games viral, and for internet, you know, email was a big thing. But I think what really drove that adoption was AOL, the AIM. Like everyone, and you know, everyone used AIM at that time, and that started getting people into dial-up, and then it got people into DSL, and then all of a sudden more and more people were adopting it. And
right.
So we just need that viral use case in order to help that spark initially getting there.
For sure.
Yeah.
So let's lead that into kind of like what you guys are doing. So, you know, you do the micro task like we talked about, but then also you just released this new product that mm-hmm. you can earn Bitcoin back rewards, essentially, or crypto rewards.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, our first product was okay in terms of like being able to get small amounts of rewards, but we wanted to do something that everyday users would be doing anyway and trying to give more money back. And that was the form of shopping. So we created a browser extension called Storm Shop, where essentially you just have it installed, and we have over 400 different companies that you can shop from. So like Macy's or eBay or Groupon or Microsoft, where if you just shop, you get cash back in the form of different types of crypto. So we support Bitcoin, Ethereum, Litecoin, DAI, and Storm. So it's pretty seamless. All you have to do is have it installed, and then the money, just cashback, just comes to you in a percentage of whatever you spent at a certain vendor. So no, like we're trying to reduce the friction it requires into, you know, trying to buy and sell through all the different exchanges and things like that, and just being able to earn.
Yeah. How are the brands responding to that you're working with? Like, what are their thoughts on it?
Yeah, so, I mean, yeah, Natasha, you know, she's the one that is reaching out to different brands. We get rejected and approved at the same time, but, yeah, most are pretty receptive because we help them drive sales, and they're not going to complain about more revenue coming through. But then it's very interesting how companies like Facebook and Google also don't let us advertise just because we are in the crypto space. But at the same time, Facebook has their own cryptocurrency coming out, so it's super ironic, and maybe they're trying to kill competition, but we don't know what the reason is. But yeah, I mean, so far, I mean, I'm sure you guys have all seen the headlines, like almost every major company is now involved in blockchain somehow.
Right.
Like even Walmart and definitely all the local companies.
No, yeah, I mean, and even companies that you might not think, like John Deere, right? Like John Deere Tractors has people working on blockchain. Right?
I didn't know that.
Yeah. So like a lot of times it's companies that are Fortune 500, but you might not even think of are definitely thinking, at least have someone working on it or thinking through it.
Yeah. I mean, there's just so many different use cases that, I mean, the ones that do make sense, right? Not just ones that are just trying to do the whole, you know, coin flip thing, like that can't, it's not even possible anymore, but
right.
Back then, but now we're definitely seeing a lot of legitimate use cases coming out. So,
totally. Yeah, I think for me, I've always, you know, I've been in commerce for a long time in different iterations, and, you know, I've always thought that, you know, loyalty and retention, and it's just a really interesting use case for the coin element of things, right? Like a lot of times I feel like there's just some startups out there that try to introduce this coin concept into applications that don't necessarily make sense or even need coins, mm-hmm. right? So you're introducing mechanics, things that aren't there. I was talking to a founder the other day, and they were telling me about like how they're going to issue this coin for, I don't know, for what was it about? I don't even remember what it was about, but then he starts talking about like, and then we're going to burn this and we're going to do that. And it was, and like, we're going to then talk to get these big enterprises. And I go, I want you to like just say that out loud. Could you imagine talking to an enterprise and saying like, oh, like this thing that you're going to buy some, we're going to burn some of it. And then it's just a mechanic and a behavior that they're not used to. Like maybe that works in some hypothetical future, but that's likely not going to take place today.
Yeah, definitely.
So great. Well, you know, let's kind of shift away from Storm just in general. What are things that get you excited about just the whole space to begin with from a, you know, like from the cryptocurrency side and then, you know, the blockchain side and I guess everything in between? What are the things that kind of excite you?
I mean, definitely, I'm still really excited about payments. I think banking and all these credit card fees, and they're going to start to dissolve relatively soon, probably over the next decade. Like wire transfer fees are something that I absolutely hate just because you have to go to a bank for most banks. And like, why am I doing this from 9 to 5 when I have to work? And then there's a 1 hour long queue because the banks have automated everything and now there's less bankers available and it takes me forever. And you know, with Bitcoin, I can do it 3 a.m. and from my bed, and it takes me like 10 seconds to send something out. And so technology is already there. So why haven't we caught up yet? It's because the profit margins are there. So I think that will start being dissolved. I mean, even like, I think Facebook, Google, Apple, Uber, all these big fintech companies are starting to get into all these companies are starting to get into fintech, and so they're going to start dissolving it, whether it's through blockchain or not. And so,
sure.
But I think, yeah.
I was reading some magazine or some news outlet, and they're talking about how banks fear the FANG companies more than really anything because of the fact of them trying to basically turn into banks, right?
Yeah.
Like Google or Facebook or Apple being their own banks. It's super interesting. Sorry, you touched on something that I was going to ask you about. So, you know, just payments overall, I agree. I think payments are super interesting. Let's kind of dive into that a little bit more, right? Because a lot of times as consumers, we might think that things are faster than they are because the bank essentially, you know, deposit is into our account, but it's not technically there, right?
Let's
kind of talk through that real quick for those that might not be aware of that. Like, you know, I send you a wire, or there might be something pending in your account, but the funds haven't really transferred.
Yeah.
So if it doesn't go through, then you get fined, or you get a penalty, I get a penalty, and so forth.
Yeah.
You know, how does that work?
Yeah, I mean, why do we need, I mean, the clearinghouses are there to protect, you know, both sides from just sort of fraud and, you know, payments that actually don't have a balance. But I think one of the problems is definitely because the banks actually don't carry all the cash that they, you know, are supposed to have on behalf of the customers. They only have a fraction of it. And I think that's why a lot of the early Bitcoin sort of fan base are really excited about, because, you know, every Bitcoin actually exists, and, you know, that you can't just borrow against the smaller percentage of it. So I think that's definitely the interesting case. But I mean, if the balance is there and someone decides to send it, just that's it. There shouldn't have to be any more friction outside of that.
What are your thoughts on just, you know, stable coins overall, right? Like, especially from like a in a commerce context, what are your thoughts there?
Yeah, it's super interesting. Just because
I'm a huge fan of them.
Yeah,
I'm a huge fan of them in theory. Yeah. Right. Like, I don't know in practice just yet because we haven't seen a lot of it.
Yeah. So what Facebook's trying to do is like one of the most interesting things because they're trying to essentially be the world's largest government, right? So they have almost 2 billion people under their access, and if they create money, and you know whether this is backed to all these different currencies or not, they're locally creating the world's largest government. If you have power, the power comes from money. So then all of a sudden Facebook just becomes this behemoth, and I think that's why the US is trying to stop them. But at the same time, China's creating their own digital currency, and now the government's a little bit anxious on what to do. Like, maybe we should support Facebook, or maybe, but I don't think the US dollar is gonna convert into a digital currency anytime soon. But China's really damn close, because if you're there, everyone's using WeChat and Alipay.
For sure.
Like, nobody's using cash. And so all of that is digitized. And it's one way that the governments can actually control the behaviors of their residents, because if someone does something bad, then they can just shut off all their accounts. And if you don't have cash, then you really don't have any options. And so
it's kind of like the negative, creepy side of blockchain, right? Yeah. Like, in using that context. In the China context, it's very much a government control mechanism, right?
There's actually a conspiracy saying that the NSA created the Bitcoin, and they're just trying to get everyone to, because all the money launderers and all these guys have so far, you know, used cash, right, to do all these illicit activities. And if the cash is gone, and everyone moves to digital, and then all of a sudden with blockchain, like, it's not completely private.
You know,
you can track it to a certain degree if anyone has ever access KYC through an exchange, or you know, if I send through Jonathan sends to, you know, one of these guys, and then someone else gets sent, but I went through KYC, so then you can track it backwards and to see where those funds came. So you can subpoena me, then subpoena him, and then you can also find where that track. So
yeah, you essentially are just like making like a big decision tree, right?
Yeah.
And like pointing and figuring out where maybe you don't know that it's my wallet, but you know that Simon sent it to me, and you know Sally sent it to me, and it's like, wait a second, we can kind of triangulate this here.
And so that's what China's doing, right? So, but I think, I think U.S. can also do that as well too. There's recently there was, I think child pornography guy that was running a website in Korea, and the U.S. FBI and the Korean government tracked them down together to find this culprit using blockchain. They just found all the Bitcoin transactions that was going through his wallet address. And so it's super fascinating. Like, I don't think you can be able to do that with fiat as easily, because everything would have been done under cash or like prepaid gift cards. I think that was the one way that a lot of people were laundering money. But yeah, it's just going to be sort of a scary aspect when you start seeing like communist governments like China start taking over
for sure
money.
No, I've definitely read a few articles on that where they're talking about different, you know, federal or government agencies that actually prefer the movement in cryptocurrency because of that very reason, like you're talking about. Mm-hmm. There's actually kind of in that same vein, there were these two Bitcoin, or I don't know if it was Bitcoin accounts, but some crypto wallets that were actually sanctioned. And like, so they didn't know like who owned these wallets, but they just knew that the people that were sending money to that were basically from sanctioned countries. So they're saying like, okay, well then these wallets we know are sanctioned, so they could kind of figure that out. It's really interesting. So you're from Korea, your family's from Korea, right?
Yeah.
What is, I've never been to Korea, but I've read a lot about Korea when it comes to cryptocurrency. Mm-hmm. And what I've heard is just on a completely like another level, just the level of sophistication by like the average user like a lot of people own cryptocurrency in Korea, is that correct?
It was until the prices fell.
Okay.
I think like 2018, in like the beginning of 2018, I think like 10% of the entire population had cryptocurrencies. It was like, it was absurd on how many people had it, but definitely it's died down quite a bit. But at the same time, a lot of companies are building really aggressively towards blockchain, and a lot of the major institutions as well too. Like Kakao and Line are some of the biggest companies that are building there. But I mean, even here, we have like Amazon and Microsoft building lots of blockchain solutions. So I think from a company standpoint, like everyone's doing that. But definitely retail use case has gone down quite a bit. There was an article that came out recently, I think, back at the height of the bull market, like 33% of fiat to ETH transactions came from Korea, and now it's like 0.2%. So,
oh, wow.
Interesting fact about Korea is like, they're like the U.S. person on average holds up stock for about 3 days to 7 days. An average person in Korea holds it for 2 hours. And so there's just really, it's kind of jumpy at sort of like what's hot and what's not. And so if there's like an opportunity to earn money, I think people are very quick to follow trends.
Yeah.
Yeah, a lot of day traders. But when the money's dried up, obviously not as much interest, but so still, yeah.
I have no idea if this is true or not, but does that have to do with like gambling? Like, is gambling, gambling's illegal?
Yeah,
because I remember hearing about that, like gambling's illegal.
Yeah.
So because gambling's illegal, like other things kind of feel like gambling that you can kind of get away with. Do you know anything about that?
Yeah, so or like, am I just making going that back to the whole stock market thing, like, you know, people get very obsessed, like too much that it becomes risky. And so, gambling in Korea is illegal, but there's one casino that's sponsored by the government that's like 2 hours away from Seoul that's open. And so if you want to get a table seat at the blackjack table, you have to wait 3 to 4 hours just to get a seat. And so like people camp out there the entire day, and then they actually have to shut off the casinos from a certain hour, like I think it was like 4 a.m. to 7 a.m. or something like that. And then just because the addiction level is really crazy. But it's not just Korea. It's like a lot of Asian cultures also do that as well. And they're very high tech, like the technology is very sophisticated. And you mix that with crypto, which all of a sudden felt like this gambling tool with, you know, going up and down really fast and a lot of volatility, and people were just really excited. And I think, you know, now we're sort of taking a breather and just letting good technology come through. And this has definitely been, you know, we sort of needed this bear market for a long time to normalize things.
Well, it's nice. I mean, I totally agree. It's definitely thinned out a lot of the stench, I guess, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And like what's kind of staying are the companies that are building product, that are focusing on the tech, right? It's a build phase, as it should be. And you know, a lot of people compare Bitcoin or blockchain to like the internet, and it's like, I don't know that this is necessarily like our dot-com bubble like had happened.
Yeah.
You know, maybe like that's still on the horizon, I don't know. But it's definitely cleaned some things through.
Yeah.
Nice. Well, I'd love to open it up to some questions for people if anybody has it. And since we're recording, I'll try to keep your question short and concise so I can remember it to repeat it so we can get it on the audio. Does anybody have a question for Simon? If not, I got plenty. Okay.
Yeah. How do you deal with regulations? It's like especially looking into like global expansion.
Yeah.
How do you deal with regulations overall?
Yeah, and I think every crypto company in the U.S. feels this. It's a pain point. It's not clear, and that's the hard part, is we're always trying to guess on where the regulations will go. So every crypto company needs to have a lot of lawyers and sort of be a fortune teller and give us predictions on what we can do. But everything's in a gray area until like the regulations are actually set, and things are still not set. And that's what is really tough, because you have all these really expensive lawyers telling you it could go this way, it could go that way. So, you know, you should do this, but at the same time, we can't guarantee that this is actually going to happen. So, okay, like, what do you want us to do? And then, so we have to just sort of take the best guess of like what we're trying to do. But at the same time, like on our side, we try to be really conservative. Like we did do a crowd sale in the US, but one of the things that we did was we KYC'd every single user. And that was something that we were one of the first companies to do so. And everyone hated it, because like the form of like, I'm not gonna send you my passport, like all this information, like why should I do that to, you know, like, you know, invest in this like crowd sale and stuff like that. But regardless, we did it just because we thought this was gonna help in the long run. Like we definitely didn't want like anyone from ISIS or like black money laundering or something like that coming into us, because, you know, 1MDB scandal and all these things, and like that's more scary than, you know, anything that else that could happen. So it's all sort of, you know, just weighing your risks and trying to see like, you know, how, you know, you can stay compliant for what's gonna happen in the next 5 to 10 years, not just now.
Anybody else have a question? Go ahead.
You mentioned payments. What would you say, companies such like Venmo, also Wells Fargo came out with that Zelle. So they are moving to the digital world.
Mm-hmm.
How would that apply to something that you're doing, something like Venmo? Because Venmo it's pretty flawless to a certain extent. It's just used today's technology. It's just your user interface and your easiness of transactions is just 20 times easier than any other fiduciary institution.
Yeah.
So, you know, kind of like, how do you compare to Venmo or to Zelle, and you know, how does that affect what you're doing? One thing I wanted to say real quick, and you probably know this, that so Zelle was actually a project or a company formed by several banks, right? It wasn't just Wells Fargo. I think that's really interesting, right? It was Wells Fargo, JP Morgan, Bank of America, and probably some others. They were like, hey, like we need to make sure that we're able to move money a little bit quicker because we're going to get our lunch eaten by some of these startups. I could see that happening, you know, on the crypto side, and arguably JPM coin is kind of a little bit of that there. But go ahead, Simon.
Yeah, no, that's a very valid point too. But so if you actually looked at Venmo's quarterly loss last quarter, it's huge, right? I think it was like $300 million or $1 billion. I can't remember the exact numbers, but it was massive. And you know, even though the technology there, the UX is really friendly, and you know, PayPal owns Venmo, is still eating up a ton of money just because they are still using the legacy system in the back. In the front, you know, before you actually cash out to the bank, they're basically just making a number go up and down, right? And so it doesn't cost them anything. But at the same time, if you do send it to a bank, they're gonna eat the same ACH fees that all the clearinghouses and all the middlemen control. So it's really inefficient, right? So regardless of the UX being really pretty in the front, it's not scalable right now. So if they shift to, you know, JP Morgan coin or something like that, where it's much more cost efficient, then they can totally do it. But that's why blockchain really is interesting.
Yeah, going with what you said, it's a nice UX, but it's using old rails, mm-hmm. right? And so when we think about blockchain or cryptocurrency, it's like, hey, let's have this nice UX, but let's rethink what this might look like under a new rail system, right? Who else? Carlos?
You mentioned China, they're going to be introducing their own stable coin, that's not going to be on any public networks as far as I know. It's going to be their own network, right?
Yeah, so he's asking a question about China, and you know, is it going to be a stable coin? It's going to be their own network. What do you know about that?
Yeah, so the rumors are that they're creating a stable coin, but basically it's a way to control capital outflow. So, you know, all these exchanges, right? So they have a fiat pairing. So whether it's Bitcoin, there's like a USD pairing, there is, you know, like CNY and all these different things. But if you make every single cryptocurrency, and when you withdraw or deposit it, have to touch the, you know, Chinese digital currency, then you're going to be able to see transparency, like every single transaction of money that ever exists within China. So if all these like corrupt, you know, politicians or whatever that are trying to smuggle money out through US and, you know, US real estate and Australia or whatever they're investing in, they're going to be able to catch it, and they're going to be able to stop that and, you know, get all the China money stop flowing out of the country.
Totally.
Yeah.
Totally.
I have a question about how stuff works. Do you run your own chain behind it, or you kind of work like a wallet?
Yeah, so how does Storm work? Do you operate your own chain, or are you just a wallet?
Yeah.
Provide some details there.
Yeah, so we're not a wallet. So we're an Ethereum-based chain right now. So we have an Ethereum-based token called Storm. But I'm sure most of you guys know that Ethereum doesn't really scale, and we do a ton of transactions. So we do a lot of it off-chain. So we aggregate a lot of the transactions, just sort of the Venmo method, where it's just going up in points. And then when the user actually wants to withdraw or redeem, then we actually use a smart contract, and then we send out the payments, and so we batch it, and we try to make it as efficient so we can reduce the cost to send it out as much as possible.
Kind of use it like as a record management tool.
Yeah, it's just like a ledger, so.
Yeah, makes sense. Who else has questions? Let's kind of go back to the whole payment network thing when we think about that, and you know, I kind of want to touch more on this Venmo topic. We hear things like, you know, blockchain is bad or Bitcoin is bad, and then, you know, what is it, like something like 90% of all dollars have traces of cocaine on them or something, right? Or it's 80%. It's a high percentage, okay. Right? I don't know. So, you know, why do you think that narrative came out to begin with? One, like, is that a narrative that's kind of like is that an ignorance narrative? Is that a forced narrative? You know, what are kind of your thoughts on that?
I think it's just, education, right? So people don't like uncertainty, or like they don't, they're not familiar with the technology. And, the first use case for a lot of technology was used for illicit. I think even the internet, right?
Oh, totally. Like video.
Yeah.
Right? Like
pornography.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So,
like, those guys are just the ones that are willing to, dive into new technology the first, because there's an alternative method that makes their process easier. But at the same time, like, once mainstream adoption does happen, I think it's fine. Like, I mean, I'm completely fine with the government, like, seeing my transactions and stuff. I'm not doing any, like, illegal drug buying or anything like that. So I'm fine with it moving to digital currency. I think it's more convenient, and the transaction fees are a lot lower. And then if the U.S. government doesn't have to print a bunch of dollars and coins and things like that, we can also save a ton of money. And so, if we are moving into that area, I don't know the exact statistics on the adoption of Apple Pay, but Apple Pay's adoption is getting really fast, right? And so they're working with a ton of merchants, get cash back, and all you have to do is just tap it. And, credit cards are even starting to get extinct because of that too.
I mean, really what it comes down to, as with all technologies, is this an improvement on my life? Is it easier? And so kind of what we were talking about earlier is it just really takes that overall adoption from a UX standpoint and solving the pain to derive that and get that. It seems like there's different things that are coming out that are making that a lot easier and so forth. Anybody else have a question? No? Okay. I'd love to kind of talk about what do you see as the really interesting use cases outside of commerce, right? Mm-hmm. Like for blockchain or crypto or currency or whatever, what kind of gets you excited? Obviously as a founder, you're very focused on your domain, but if you were, if you could clone yourself and do something else what are the things that kind of get you interesting?
Yeah, I mean, right now the most popular trend in blockchain is DeFi, so decentralized finance, and it's sort of giving you better interest rates and also being able to lend out a lot cheaper because you don't need, banks to do that. And some of these places are offering really, really high interest rates, up to 18% and some of them for a savings account. And it's really cool.
Right. How sustainable do you think that is?
Yeah, that's a good question, because they're basically, how they're funding it is they're doing 150% collateral. So if you want to get a loan of $7,500, and you need to put in 150% of that. So you need a lot more than actually $7,500 to, get that loan. But, I think it's really interesting. It's still pretty early. There's definitely going to be a hack or some big thing that's going to be a disruptor.
Sure.
Just because there's so much money coming through. They're constant, ETH and all the different, stable coins that are being locked up for these DeFi. It's like a hockey stick graph right now. Everyone is putting money into it because they're getting 8% interest every month. And it's a really cool company called BlockFi. I think they're based in New York, but it's not decentralized. But at the same time, their UX is pretty easy to use. You just set it up, and you can deposit your Bitcoin and get 6-point-something% back, ETH 4-point-something% back, and they have a stable coin worth Gemini that's worth 8.6%, I think. And they pay out every month, so it's just compounding. And so if you're holding Bitcoin or Ethereum, and you can just put it on there, and it just keeps compounding more Bitcoin and Ethereum every month. And if you want to just keep it stable and just have it like a savings account, you can just put it in their Gemini USD and get 8.6% per year. Which I think at Chase, I get 0.05%, and it's just ridiculous because they're charging 22% for my credit card. So it's just that gap, that spread is just too much. I think BlockFi and things like this it's an experiment. Like I said, they don't have FDIC insurance, and they're pretty clear about that too. So if they get hacked, then it's gone. So that's your risk. But there are companies like Coinbase that do have FDIC insurance, and they just come up with a stable coin. I don't know what their interest rate is. I think it's around 2%, but
it's 1.25%. It's 1.25%, 1.5%.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, but then if you're gonna use that, there's a company called Wealthfront that's better. I think it's 1.86%, right? And that's not crypto related. So, I would use the crypto alternative if the rates are significantly different.
For the security,
but also I would like to have the peace of mind of having FDIC insurance in case getting hacked. Because crypto getting hacked is very common. And you see even the largest exchange like Binance and Upbit getting hacked. So,
sure,
it can just happen. And then I don't want $2,000 out of hell to be gone all of a sudden just because some North Korean hacker got it.
Right.
Yeah,
BlockFi actually just got approved in the state of Washington, so you can use it in the state of Washington. So, you know, going with that, when I think about that scenario, I think about, what would happen if all of a sudden, like, there's a massive drop in the market, and, like, you know, how would a company correct around that? I don't know if they could solve for that, like, right?
Yeah.
If we saw, like, you know, if the price cuts cut in half or whatever.
Yeah. So you get liquidated, I think, if you're at, like, 60% collateral or something like that. Like,
got it.
40 or 60%, yeah. So if Bitcoin drops to 4K next week, then you're going to get liquidated, and then you're going to lose whatever you had under the collateral. So it's, if you borrowed money from them. So
got it. So. And so as long, yeah, got it. That makes sense.
Yeah.
So last thing I want to talk about, cause I feel like you'd have opinions on this. So I don't know the answer. I don't claim to know how finance works, but one thing I find super interesting is this notion that, like, in a bad financial market, Bitcoin's gonna go up in value,
mm-hmm.
right? Like, so, like, if the US economy or the world economy tanks, Bitcoin's gonna go up. And I don't know that I 100% believe that personally, because we haven't seen it yet,
yep.
right? Like, we've since Bitcoin has come into existence, the economy has been good, right?
Yeah.
Like, Bitcoin has never seen a poor economy.
Yeah.
There's this Iran conflict going on right now, and, you know, people are saying, like, maybe that's why Bitcoin went up.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's actually probably more just speculators,
yeah.
you know, speculating that. I don't think there's likely a noob person with lots of money that said, like, oh, I'm going to buy Bitcoin right
yeah.
now in this conflict.
I
just don't buy that. But I'm curious what your thoughts are on that. Like,
yeah.
Definitely.
I think the Iran thing was definitely speculators thinking that a bunch of Iranians are going to start buying Bitcoin. But I mean, it did happen from when Bitcoin went from like $10 to $200. What caused it was actually because of Cyprus and Greece. So Cyprus and Greece had limited people from withdrawing their bank balances, and people were starting to get really, really pissed off, because it was like, why can't I take out my own money? And so they started buying into Bitcoin. And so, you know, I think that was like Greece's second bankruptcy out of the third one or something like that. But that's what triggered it initially. And then you see countries like Venezuela too, and then just the hyperinflation that's going on. It's like, what alternative do they have? You know, the government's restricting US dollars, from buying and selling. So if Bitcoin's easier to access through local Bitcoins, then they're going to just do that. And they have, and so, like, in the US, you know, I know my dollar is going to be a dollar because everything's pegged to the US dollar right now, but we're definitely seeing, you know, other countries where that is becoming, there are instances where that correlation does happen. And, like, I think last year, the one thing that did have a little trigger was India. So they banned a lot of the higher note bills. And so basically they were trying to get everyone to report their taxes, because you had to turn in your larger bills to the bank in order to get your funds back. But and then that allows you to see the government to see if they were hiding taxes or not. And as a result, a lot of people just lit their money on fire because they'd rather not, you know, tell the government that they were avoiding taxes for several years. And so a lot of people in India were buying Bitcoin as a result, and then India ended up banning Bitcoin. And it's just, like, very interesting how that works.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, it's crazy. I'm from Venezuela, and so I talk about this kind of stuff a lot.
Mm-hmm.
But the hyperinflation in Venezuela is so absurd that right now $1 equals, I want to say it's 60 billion, believe it is. It's 8 zeros plus 5 zeros is what it is, basically. So whatever that is how much $1 is, because the government has cut off 8 zeros of the currency over the last 20 years, right? And so the Chavez government came into power in 99. And in 20 years, that's what happened to the economy there. So any last questions before we end?
What's your thoughts on what Ripple's doing?
Just
in terms of their long-term potential and global payments.
They have a lot of money. So, I mean, it depends on what they're going to do with that money, right?
Is that their pointers after their investments, or is that?
I think someone broke down, I think the Block or one of these guys broke down their actual revenue stream versus how much they liquidated their tokens, and you know they're liquidating like $300 million worth of Ripple every month. So I mean they're well capitalized, and I think the biggest question is going to be whether they're classified as a security or not, because I think that case has been going on for California for a while. But given what happened to EOS, I think the so far a lot of what the sentiment has been is like, if you can't afford the $20 million lawyer fees and things like that, then you'll be fine. But nobody knows what's going to happen. But
right, yeah, because whatever they fundraise, it's like it's just a portion, basically
yeah.
payback of like a single digit percentage of what you fundraise.
Yeah, so it was very interesting. Like for EOS and their cases, like. I think that what their settlement was $20 million.
Something like that, yeah, 20 or 24 million, I think.
And their market cap went up $300 million when that happened. So it paid off. So I think, yeah, I mean, we just don't know what's going to happen. Ripple's definitely, their mindset is more like, you know, we're going to start disrupting first and then, you know, get slapped on the wrist later, that mentality. And, you know, they're killing it in terms of execution. They're acquiring, like, MoneyGram and all these big companies, and, you know, they're partnering with all these banks, and their executive team is very they're very professional, right? And
yeah.
they know what they're doing. So I think as a company, they'll do well. Yeah.
And I have another question. So what are the big companies like Microsoft and your customers telling you they're working with you for? What do they want to get out of that?
I mean, for us, it's a very simple solution. We just help companies drive more sales or user acquisition for apps and things like that. I'd love to see, you know, what's really Microsoft and Amazon, what's behind the hood. I'm really curious. I have been for a while. I think, like, I think one of the best use cases for blockchain is actually a decentralized cloud. And if Microsoft and AWS, you know, Azure and AWS start fighting over that, it's going to be just insane, right? So, you know, Amazon's, like, revenue stream is primarily coming from AWS right now. And if all of a sudden they can decentralize that, make it more cost efficient, at the same time more secure, then you know they're going to start taking a bigger market share from Azure or you know all these other alternate, like in Google Cloud. But I think that's why IBM has been invested. They've been one of the earliest adopters, right? And I think
yeah,
I don't know what their real objective is, but I think cloud will definitely be one of the most interesting places to look
but in
for.
Terms of your the Storm token,
yeah,
and for rewards,
yeah.
How do they operationalize that?
So, I mean, we do all the blockchain stuff on our end. So, I mean, for our vendors, we try to make it as simple as possible so that everything is done in fiat. And then we use our smart contracts and, you know, our backend to reward the users in crypto. Yeah. So we try to, like, our focus is to try to make it as easy as possible for our vendors and at the same time is make it as easy as possible for users to earn. And so we try to take care of all the, like, middle inefficiencies in the middle. Yeah.
Just real quick before you end, you brought up IBM and like how they've been in it for a long time. I had the chance to interview Nitin Garr, and he was the founder of the blockchain group at IBM, and now he does the digital asset group for IBM. But you know, if you haven't listened to that podcast, I'd recommend it. It's pretty interesting. He basically talks about like 2010, 11, 12. Big retailers, big companies were going to IBM's like, hey, what's this blockchain and Bitcoin thing?
Mm-hmm.
And like, that's, they're like, okay, like we should probably start, you know, paying attention to this if these big, you know, companies are coming asking about this. Mm-hmm. Go ahead. Last question.
Yeah. Like one last question. Like apart from like finance, when it comes to like liquid assets, where do you see like most potential with blockchain in the future?
Where do you see the potential for blockchain in the future? Like, in apart from finance and perhaps liquid assets or outside of that?
Can you define like liquid assets, like what you're talking about?
Yeah, like apart from like cloud and finance, there's more like intangible assets when it comes more down to like, such as like property owners, for example.
Gotcha. Yeah, I mean, I think that was a big use case a lot of people were trying to go for, fractional ownership, like real estate and painting. Like, I think those are like really cool use cases that I would have loved to see happen, but it's sort of just died down because there wasn't enough demand. Like, I think there were quite a few companies I was going for the art as like sort of an investment opportunity, just because like a, you know, piece of Picasso could go for like $10 million, and you can't own a full Picasso, but you can own like, you know, 5/1,000,000th of it for like, you know, a couple $100s or something like that, right? And then basically all of the owners, based on the percentage that you own, would vote on whether they want to sell it or relocate it or do whatever they want to. And then, you know, if it appreciates to $20 million, everyone gets like a 2x return, right? So the theory was really cool. It's just there hasn't been a company that succeeded in doing so. I think there has been a couple companies that raised money, but the regulations and lawyers probably ended up eating all the fees. So we'll see. I mean, but I think like real estate also is really cool too, just because like, you know, here, actually, yeah, housing prices here are still pretty crazy ridiculous, but in Asia, it's even worse. You get like a tiny one bedroom apartment for like $1 million, and that's like a normal thing. You go to Hong Kong or Singapore, it's right. Absurd, right? So if people can own, you know, real estate with like three other friends using blockchain, then it'd be great instead of, because like you can actually use the smart contract to verify and the percentage of the ownership and things like that.
Yeah, totally.
Needs to hang the painting in their house. If
yeah, well, I mean, for those ones, it was like held at private security, so like you would pay, you know, a cold storage company or something like that. Yeah.
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 It's in someone's basement.
Yeah. Or whoever has 51%, because yeah, I want it.
Nice.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, Simon, is there something you want to leave everybody with, or what's kind of a question you'd like to leave people with to think about and.
I mean, I think, yeah, we're still really early. And so, like, I think there's so much opportunity in blockchain that this is just going to be massive. Like, I think the internet was, like, one layer. But blockchain is, like, everything behind the internet, from all the way from, like, payments to real estate and all these different use cases, like hospitals and ID verification, cloud. Like, it's just going to be such a massive industry. And even though, like, you know, all the prices and everything fell, like, 98%, 99%, that's what everyone talks about. I'm still really excited, and I'm very excited more than ever to just continue building. And I think, you know, I'd still be willing to sell tacos to just keep it going, you know. Yeah.
Awesome. Yeah. Well, Simon, thanks so much for taking the time to meet with us today. What are the best ways to stay in contact with you or and Storm?
Yeah, you could follow us on LinkedIn or Twitter. I think we're pretty active on both. And definitely, if you haven't checked out Storm Shop, like, please download it. I think Natasha over there, if you want to give her your email address, we'll also send you $10 worth of Storm. But our goal is to make it as much user-friendly as possible, so you just have it installed and just shop at any one of those shops that you would have normally, and we'll just give you, you know, free money back each time you shop. So, and all the feedback is really helpful because we're trying to target everyone, non-crypto users, so that feedback on telling me I'm confused on this or that would be really helpful for us. So thank you.
Awesome. Yeah. Awesome. Well, Simon, thanks so much. Give Simon a round of applause. And chat with you soon. Cool.
Thank you for listening to the TF Blockchain Podcast. Please help us continue to spread blockchain, Bitcoin, and crypto awareness by sharing this podcast, attending our events, following us on social, and rating and reviewing this podcast by clicking all the stars on our homepage so we can be more accessible across Apple, Spotify, and all podcast platforms. Thank you for your support. Keep learning, keep growing, and keep building. The views and opinions expressed at TF Blockchain events and podcasts are solely those of the ones presenting and do not necessarily reflect the positions or opinions of TF Blockchain. TF Blockchain is not responsible for the opinions or content of its guests and does not endorse any particular company or currency. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be used to make investment decisions.